At this time, I would like to turn today's presentation over to Mike Wechsler. Mike, you may begin.
Great. Thank you, Jason. Good morning. This is Michael Wechsler, and along with my colleagues, Robert Milligan and Joshua Salinas, we welcome you to this webinar. This morning, or this afternoon, depending on where you are, we will go over a number of items for you over the next hour. We strongly encourage you, if you have questions, to present those questions via the web tool, and we will try to answer those questions. We, of course, as we see your questions, try to at times gear our presentation to some of the questions that are asked, and of course, we'll try to answer questions at the end or follow up by email if you want to get those questions answered. This morning, we will cover significant United States and Supreme Court non-compete and trade secret decisions. We will cover increased involvement of government agencies in this arena. We will talk about the rise of trade secret preemption, especially in California. We will give you an overview of the legislative efforts that have gone on during the past year. We will talk to you a little bit about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the changes that we've seen amongst the circuits over the past year, as well as a little bit of detail into the Aaron Swartz situation. We will also give you an overview of the social media area and how that area has been affected by changes in trade secret, non-compete, and confidentiality law over the past year. And finally, we will note for you a number of jury trial and criminal and injunction situations that will illustrate some of the points that we're talking about this morning. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to my colleague, Robert Milligan, and he will begin to talk about our first topic.
Thanks, Michael. I'm going to discuss the significant United States and state Supreme Court non-compete and trade secret decisions. Starting off, we're going to start with a significant United States Supreme Court decision. It's the Nitrolift Technologies case. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court does not typically hear a lot of non-compete cases, so when we saw this case come out, it was definitely significant in the fact that the Supremes were making a ruling on it. And it is rather a significant case, and I think the main bottom line takeaway on the case is that employers may want to consider employing arbitration agreements along with their non-compete agreements and specifying that any disputes over non-compete agreements take place before the arbitrator in light of its decision. Obviously, it depends upon your particular company and facts, but this case does give some support that an arbitrator may be the best forum as opposed to a court. Now, the underlying facts in the case had to deal with a demand for arbitration brought by an employer against some departing employees, and that was brought in arbitration. And in response, what the employees did is filed an action for declaratory relief in Oklahoma State Court. And eventually, the Oklahoma Supreme Court took on the particular case, and the issue was whether or not it was appropriate to have this non-compete dispute in arbitration. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court essentially indicated that it was not appropriate to be in arbitration because the underlying non-compete agreement itself was unenforceable. And that's really something that the U.S. Supreme Court thought that was totally unacceptable, and that was that the Oklahoma Supreme Court essentially got to the merits of the underlying dispute and didn't just interpret whether or not the arbitration agreement itself was enforceable. And that's probably not surprising considering the Supreme Court's recent activity in the arbitration space coming out of the AT&T Mobility Concepcion case, that there's a strong policy under the Federal Arbitration Act to have arbitration and to pursue arbitration. Now, this particular case is interesting because the effect of the court's decision is that the declaratory relief that the Oklahoma Supreme Court provided, that the non-compete was unenforceable, now goes back to the arbitrator. And the arbitrator is not going to be, and the arbitration is not going to be in Oklahoma. It's actually going to be in Texas, and it's going to be applying the law of Louisiana. So that's not to say that the non-compete is necessarily going to be enforceable, because it clearly doesn't comply with Oklahoma law, but what a arbitrator in Texas may find with respect to whether the non-compete complies with Louisiana law will be interesting. And in general, employers typically like to be in court because court provides being able to get in front of the judge to get immediate injunctive relief, and there's more gravity behind a court order issuing a TRO or a preliminary injunction. But that's not to say some of the AAA or the arbitration providers do not provide provisional remedies and do not provide injunctive relief. And so in those troublesome jurisdictions where non-competes are strictly construed or not allowed at all, some employers may consider employing arbitration and employing forum selection, choice of law provisions, and consent to jurisdiction clauses to try to avail themselves of this helpful language in the Supreme Court decision. There was a number of notable state Supreme Court decisions this year, and we've listed some of the highlights from these state court decisions. Of course, you can find more details about these specific cases on our blog, tradesecretslaw.com, and we also put together a booklet that summarizes a year in review of the most significant decisions. But we just wanted to give you a tease of some of these significant decisions as it may impact your particular company and business. The first real significant decision came out of Ohio. It was the Ohio Supreme Court decision, and it's the Accordia-Fischel case. And this is a very interesting decision because it's an instance where the Ohio Supreme Court changed their mind. Initially, what they ruled was that a particular non-compete agreement that did not have any successors and assigns language indicating that if there was a merger, whether there was some sort of acquisition, that the non-compete would still be binding by the new company, that they could still enforce that particular non-compete. In the absence of specific language in the agreement, the court initially found that that would not be enforceable by the surviving company. And what happened is eventually the Ohio Supreme Court reversed their position and essentially said that by operation of law in the case of a merger that the covenants carried through, and that essentially that you would step into the shoes of the absorbed company and that the non-compete would be binding. But it's a strong reminder that in your non-compete, non-disclosure type agreements, that the best practice is, of course, to have language that indicates that the covenant will be binding by successors and assigns. And that's the best way to try to protect yourself. This decision is obviously a comfort for some who didn't have that sort of magic language in their agreement, but it's a reminder to try to include that so you don't have to deal with the issue. There was another significant decision in Ohio this past year, and it was a $26.5 million jury verdict, and it was real interesting. It originally involved a trade secret suit against a small company, and they asserted their own claims as cross-claims in the lawsuit, and they ended up obtaining this large, large jury verdict. And part of the significance was that they were able to leverage testimony and documentary evidence that showed that this was really being brought, from their perspective, for competitive purposes to essentially crush a small upstart company. And the size and magnitude of the jury award is significant, and as a reminder that in trade secret type litigation, you always have to be careful about if leveraging back as far as a bad faith misappropriation claim or some sort of unfair competition claim. And we're seeing that a little bit in California. There's a lawsuit, Zynga versus Kixi, and there's an unfair competition cross-complaint in that particular lawsuit, and that's sort of a new area that we're seeing, is that when somebody gets sued for trade secret misappropriation or breach of a non-compete agreement, we're seeing a big pushback by the defense in trying to assert their own claims. Some significant decisions also in Virginia, Illinois, and Indiana. In Virginia, there was a significant Supreme Court decision where essentially the Supreme Court sort of raised the bar for proving trade secret damages. And the upshot of the case was that if you had a lawsuit where trade secret, breach of the non-disclosure agreement, and you had some other related tort law claims, that you could not use the damages that your expert had proffered for the trade secret claim automatically to support your breach of contract and your other tort law claims. It was sort of a surprise and a bit of a puzzling decision based upon existing precedent in Virginia. Another interesting case that came out of Virginia was essentially complicating the valuation of lost goodwill damages in that particular decision. What it involved was Perot Systems and what they used to essentially try to show their goodwill damages is that the expert sought to calculate the difference between the price the business would sell for and the value of its non-goodwill assets by using actual sales figures and the valuation of its goodwill as reported in SEC filings. And the majority of the Supreme Court in Virginia took real issue with that approach, noting that the expert had used actual figures and specifically said that, you know, Perot was required to demonstrate that its sale price to the acquiring company, Dell, reflected an actual loss of goodwill. And so it didn't find that the showing on damages was sufficient in that particular case. Another significant case was the Illinois Supreme Court, and this is interesting and a reminder to employers as far as not invading the privacy of current and former employers. In that particular case, it was a non-compete type case, and the company had used a private investigator, and that private investigator in turn subcontracted out to another investigator to obtain the former employee's telephone records. And then once the telephone records were obtained, they were provided to the employer, and the employer used the telephone records to try to use them to call on customers to see if they had been contacted and whatnot. And the Illinois Supreme Court recognized a tort of intrusion upon seclusion. So that's significant and something that you should take into account when you're conducting a trade secret investigation or any sort of investigation that may involve personal records, personal information, that not to use methods that would get you into trouble. And, you know, in this particular instance, the investigator essentially under false pretenses obtained the telephone records, and ultimately the employer was held responsible for that conduct. Another case was significant in Indiana. In Indiana, they have this, and in some other states, they have this blacklisting statutes. And essentially, a blacklisting statute is something where some sort of activity, actions by a prohibitor that would, or actions by an employer that would prevent an employee from getting future employment. And that's obviously troublesome because Indiana is also a jurisdiction that allows non-compete agreements. And so how you reconcile those two notions that employers can't interfere with the future employment opportunities of an employee and then also at the same time enforce a non-compete agreement. And so the Indiana Supreme Court added some clarity in this space and essentially said, well, yeah, we still have this this blacklisting statute, and it may be something of the past and no longer applicable in today's world, but to make clear that, you know, simply put, a lawsuit, successful or not, to protect trade secrets or seeking to enforce non-competition agreements does not, on its own, fall within the scope of the blacklisting laws. And so, you know, employers in Indiana and other states with blacklisting laws can breathe a little bit easier now that the blacklisting law doesn't apply where you're just filing a lawsuit to enforce a non-competition agreement, and it doesn't, you know, depend upon, you know, whether you were successful or not, so that you don't necessarily have exposure by just pursuing such a lawsuit. Four other notable decisions. We had one in Missouri, and Missouri is definitely a pro non-compete jurisdiction, and the Missouri Supreme Court reaffirmed that principle in a very strong decision. Things that you should probably know about Missouri is that they, by statute, they allow non-solicitation of employee provisions up to 1 year. And that particular instance, one of the issues was it wasn't necessarily clear whether it was limited to 1 year and whether you could get something more than 1 year. And essentially, the Missouri Supreme Court said that it depends upon the facts and circumstances if you want more than 1 year, but certainly, per the statute, an employee non-solicitation agreement of up to 1 year would be enforceable. The court also enforced the non-compete that was involved in the case, and also enforced the employee non-solicitation covenant applying to customers that the employee had serviced. The court wasn't willing to go so far as to enjoin prospective customers because there was not enough clarity about what particular prospective customers that the employee had agreed not to solicit. But so again, a nice reminder that Missouri is definitely a pro-non-compete jurisdiction. Two interesting decisions out of South Carolina, one dealing with privacy and the other dealing with an invention assignment agreement. With respect to the privacy one, the claim was that there was a violation of the Stored Communications Act. And in sort of a novel decision, South Carolina Supreme Court found that there was not liability under the Stored Communications Act because it wasn't a stored communication, and that the plaintiff had already read the email, and to assert the claim under the Stored Communications Act was not actionable. Somewhat of a curious decision, and a lot of people have commented about, well, what would make out a violation of the Stored Communications Act if that wouldn't? But all's not lost on that, and that goes both ways for employers and employees. I mean, you can still try to maintain claims under sort of the Baby Computer Fraud and Abuse Acts in particular states, and as well as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Another decision that came out of South Carolina, and essentially the upshot of that decision was that invention assignment agreements, which are often employed by employers along with their non-compete or trade secret protection agreement, they're not going to be subject to the rule of reason standard. And so that was a bit of refreshing for employers in South Carolina, so that there's not necessarily going to be a higher level of scrutiny that would apply to the enforceability of a non-compete agreement, and that invention assignment agreements were sort of carved out from that higher level of scrutiny. One decision, a bit of a surprise in Georgia, and we'll be getting into this later in the presentation, about this growing movement about trade secret preemption. And trade secret preemption essentially is this notion that if you have the theft of information and the information doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret, that somehow you could be precluded from bringing tort claims based upon that theft of information, and that you'd essentially be left with a trade secret claim, and you couldn't allege, you know, certain claims such as breach of fiduciary duty or tortious interference, conversion. And we're seeing a lot of movement in that space as far as there's a growing movement of preempting common law claims. It's a bit of disturbing from an employer's perspective, because oftentimes meeting the high level of a trade secret can be difficult, but when they steal your stuff and you feel like you're aggrieved, it's troublesome for it to be told that, well, you can't maintain those claims unless you can make the real higher showing of a trade secret. And that's exactly what the Georgia Supreme Court did. Essentially, as they said that the employer was precluded from suing under the state's trade secret statute because the information didn't qualify as a trade secret, but at the same time, they were prohibited by that statute from bringing common law claims. And then finally, another notable decision is the Nevada Supreme Court decision, which recognized for the first time, although implicitly, that restrictive covenants, non-competes, may be enforceable against independent contractors. And that kind of varies by state. Certainly, very difficult in California to employ non-competes with independent contractors, obviously not post-term, but it also depends upon states as far as whether they'll allow you to have non-competes with independent contractors. But at least in Nevada, the Nevada Supreme Court reaffirmed that you could. And then finally, before I turn it back over, what we're seeing is more and more cases dealing with choice of law, forum selection, consent to jurisdiction clauses. And three cases I wanted to highlight coming out of California or the Ninth Circuit. One had to do with just the choice of law provision. It's the Ruiz versus Affinity Logistics Corp case. And in that particular case, it was a contractual choice of law provision calling for the application of Georgia law. And the court there found that it was unenforceable because California had a materially greater interest than Georgia did in the outcome of the case. And I think the significance of that is that there wasn't a forum selection issue in the particular case. Either the employer didn't employ a forum selection case or it wasn't litigated. But what you see in the Hegwire and Harstein cases that are noted on your PowerPoint, in those particular cases, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, choice of law provisions were used in the agreement, the real issue came down to the forum selection provision. And what that means is, in those particular cases, it was an employee in California who was trying to challenge their non-compete agreement. And the non-compete agreement contained a forum selection provision providing for a Pennsylvania forum as opposed to a California forum. And so I think a lot of people in California would have said that maybe perhaps the court would look beyond the forum selection clause and say, well, if I send this case to Pennsylvania, perhaps the court would enforce the non-compete, and that would be contrary to you know, California public policy as codified by Business Professions Code 16600. The court didn't do that. The court said, we don't look at the outcome or the potential outcome. We look at what the standard is for the enforcement of a forum selection provision, and it's essentially a reasonableness standard as you know, put forth by various Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And the court essentially said, yeah, well, I'm not going to look at the possible outcome. I have no way to know what the Pennsylvania court is necessarily going to do with the choice of law analysis, but I do know that this is a correct forum because there was at least some connection to Pennsylvania. Either they were incorporated there, or they did business there, there were customers there, and so the court found that the particular forum selection clause was enforceable. In the in one case, they transferred the case to Pennsylvania. That was the Hegwire case, and then in the Harstein case, they actually dismissed the declaratory relief lawsuit. So that was, I think that could be a bit of a shock to some California employers, the extent to which the federal courts in California were willing to enforce forum selection clauses. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation back over, and we'll move on to the next topic, which is the increased involvement of government agencies. Mike Wexler, who's a former prosecutor, is going to cover this topic.
Thank you, Robert. The government has been quite active, and when I say government, we mean various state and federal agencies have been very active in the trade secret non-compete computer fraud and social media space over the last year. The FBI recently has launched a public initiative to attempt to curb trade secret violations and generally intellectual property theft. The FBI has noted or they estimate that approximately $13 billion in economic loss has occurred since October 2011 because of intellectual property theft. The FBI has gone so far as to, just in May, open a website which is dedicated to educating the public on trade secret issues and has taken out billboards throughout the country with messages such as Protect America's Trade Secrets. So the FBI has made this a priority and is taking steps to grow public awareness about this area. You know, it's not just a federal agency, but also a state agency such as the Nevada Attorney General and then also the FTC, which again would be a federal agency. They have taken steps regarding issues related to trade secrets and non-competes. For example, in Nevada, there was a business which acquired, there's a healthcare company acquired a couple of cardiologist practices, and it caused concern from the Attorney General and the FTC that the behavior was anti-competitive, which, you know, in some instances would seem to be Sherman Act violations. But they were looking at the reduced aspects of competition and then the non-competes that were entered into with the cardiologists. And so they actually ventured into the non-compete space. And ultimately, and we understand it, there was a settlement that took place between this healthcare company as well as the Attorney General and FTC. But again, agencies are treading more and more into the non-compete space, and that's just one example. The Department of Justice has been very active over the past couple years in the non-hire provision space. A couple years ago, the Justice Department obtained a settlement and consent decree from a couple from a few high-tech companies, which had, according to the Justice Department, had amongst themselves agreed not to hire or not to solicit each other's employees. And they found that to be a violation of the antitrust statutes, the Sherman Act, and thus obtained a favorable disposition in that case. Because of that, civil litigation was launched. There's currently pending a class action lawsuit, multi-district litigation, the high-tech employee, I believe it's called the high-tech employee antitrust case, in which private citizens have joined in a class and are going after these companies for allegedly, and there's quite a bit of detail around it, but thumbnail sketch, allegedly depressing salaries and preventing employees from having movement, which could have increased their salaries, is the gist of that, what's being alleged. So the Justice Department was very active in an area which commonly they have not always been active in. And recently, the Justice Department launched another one of these types of lawsuits against another high-tech company within the past few months. And once again, they were alleging that there were some agreements between companies that were improper. Not only do you see the FBI, the Department of Justice, and other agencies treading into this area, but also the NLRB has tread into this area. And by that we mean they are issuing all kinds of opinions, and there are decisions coming down related to social media and the use of social media, and ultimately employers having an interest in protecting confidential information. And because of that, these social media policies have gotten on the radar screen of the NLRB because of different types of policies that employers have put into effect, attempting to limit what employees can do on social media sites, as well as what they can put on there, as well as there have been various issues around gaining access to social media sites and asking employees for their passwords into these social media sites. A little more detail on a couple of these things, because it's quite interesting and comes up in a couple of different contexts. The Justice Department, when they are looking at this issue of companies agreeing with one another to potentially not solicit each other's employees or hire each other's employees, it comes up in a few contexts. One is obviously if there's some backroom deal that's alleged to have gone on between companies, that's one scenario. Another scenario that certainly one should look at is what if two companies are involved in litigation, non-compete litigation, rating litigation, and they settle their case or they seek an injunction, one company seeks an injunction against the other to prevent the hiring or to prevent the movement of employees. Does that run afoul of anything? And then, of course, a straight old settlement of a dispute. Does that run afoul of anything? So there's various scenarios in which this could come up. And I suppose another scenario is what if two companies that aren't competitors, they have an issue amongst each other about alleged rating, so they're not competitors, which query whether the Sherman Act would even apply in that situation, but if they're not competitors, does the Justice Department have any worries or concerns about companies like that agreeing to resolve a dispute involving rating, agreeing amongst each other to resolve the dispute in a way that might involve some kind of non-solicitor, non-hire agreement to resolve a legitimate dispute. So several contexts in which that can come up in, and the purpose today, of course, is to just make you aware that this issue is out there and there's been some action on this. Like we mentioned earlier, the NLRB has been going into this area of social media, and it affects this area of confidentiality as well. In particular, the NLRB issued three reports recently and has come up with reviews of various social media policies and whether they think they're overly broad. And, for example, the issue comes up whether there's concerted activity, whether employees are talking about unionizing or engaging in some kind of concerted activity, and whether they can use various social media to help themselves organize. And the NLRB has come out with some reports on this issue. We probably could have an entire webinar on social media alone, because it's quite a hot topic and there's a lot going on in that area right now. But in particular, what we want to note is that you have to be very careful in drafting social media policy so that language is not too broad to run afoul of the issues that the NLRB is raising with regard to protected activities, but specific enough to protect confidential information. And the way to do that, of course, is in a social media policy would be to have specific examples of a particular activity that is acceptable and isn't when it comes to confidential information. There have been numerous prosecutions over the past year, and we'll touch on just a couple here. And some of this you probably have seen in the news. Motorola engineer was convicted of stealing his former employer's trade secrets recently. Likewise, a General Motors engineer and her husband were convicted of stealing trade secrets for hybrid car technology. Very notable case, there was a former software engineer, CME Group, that pled guilty to charges of allegedly downloading thousands of files containing the source code that is being used for trading operations, and that that information may have gone to China. New Jersey, a jury came back convicting a former L3 employee for taking information, trade secrets, regarding navigation devices. And, of course, there's a recent decision where Colon Industries was allegedly charged with engaging in a campaign to take the trade secrets of their rival DuPont. And so there's been quite a few cases and decisions over the past year and significant move in the Economic Espionage Act area. The reason that's important is because the Economic Espionage Act is the act on which the federal government takes action against individuals who, it's like the federal trade secret statute against individuals who violate that statute and engage in what would be criminal activity. One example to note, the U.S. versus Alenikoff decision where an employee was alleged to have violated the Economic Espionage Act, And essentially, the federal government wasn't able to prove that claim because the court felt that the requirement that the information be used in interstate or foreign commerce wasn't met. And so because of that, what we've seen is some legislation that has been used to address that situation recently in some changes in the Economic Espionage Act and the definitions of some of those. Some of the points of the statute. Right now, I'll turn this over to my colleague, Josh Salinas, who will go into important legislative efforts that have gone on during the past year.
Thanks, Michael. We have seen some significant legislative developments in trade secrets, non-compete, and computer fraud law. As Michael just previously discussed, there was some amendments to the Economic Espionage Act. First, there was the Trade Secrets Clarification Act, and what that did is it was in response to the Alenikoff case, where the defendant in that case wasn't liable under the statute because the computer source code that was allegedly taken was not a product. It was a product or placed in interstate commerce, and so to prevent cases such as that from happening again, the language was amended to cover trade secret information that is related to a product or service that is used in or intended to be used in interstate commerce. And so it covers computer source codes, but services, systems, information that's not necessarily a physical manifestation of a product, but is still used in commerce. There was another amendment that increased penalties for the Economic Espionage Act. That's the Penalty Enhancement Act, and it expanded the upper limit, the ceiling for liability under the act to be, for individuals, $500,000. It was increased to $5 million, and then for organizations, it was the greater of either $10 million or the three times the value of the stolen information. And so we see these amendments of broadening protection for trade secrets, increasing penalties, reflecting a increased interest by the government to protect the national economy and to really protect companies and their global competitive edge in the global marketplace. And so we see that there's momentum going towards private, federal, civil causes of action for the theft of trade secret information. There was some federal trade secret legislation proposed this year. There was three senators. It was Chris Coons of Delaware, Herb Cole of Wisconsin, and Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. And what this did is it provided a federal cause of action for trade secret theft. Right now, a majority of states have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act, but to bring a claim, there's still this patchwork of state laws. And so trade secret holders or plaintiffs would have this federal cause of action for redress. The idea was welcomed, but there were some notable criticisms of the language of that proposed legislation. Specifically, the legislation provided for an ex parte seizure process where items, devices that were either used for the misappropriation of trade secrets or there was a fear that those devices have evidence of misappropriation that needed to be preserved and avoid destruction. There was the ability for to bring an ex parte seizure proceeding and obtain this information. The concern was that once this order was issued, there was no procedures or guidelines for what actually happened to those devices, those items, after they were seized. And so the fear was that there was no information of, who would be storing or collecting these devices, who would have access to these devices, and if there were, there were no penalties for any abuse or mistakes of this process. And so the fear was that, a competitor could bring this ex parte seizure order, obtain access to another competitor's trade secrets, and there wasn't, really any penalties or motivation for them to not to really comply with the proper procedures. And so there was fear that, this could be abused. And so this legislation did die, but there's still, talks and expected further legislation for this year. Now, some of the notable developments in legislation were stuff that actually was not enacted that failed. Specifically, there was the SOPA and PIPA anti-piracy legislation. These faced some pretty immense public backlash, and there was widespread protest against this. These two pieces of legislation were targeting foreign rogue websites that maybe were aiding in intellectual property theft or copyright infringement, and they were outside the scope of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, so there was no authority or control against them. And so there were some, the ability of the in SOPA and PIPA was for the Attorney General to have access or authority to issue orders against search engines such as Google, Bing, Yahoo, to block access or to restrict access to these foreign infringing websites, to block off intermediate payment providers such as PayPal, who are maybe providing funds to these websites. But there was concern of restricting and censoring the internet, restricting freedom of speech, and the lack of due process should these payment providers be denied payment access. There was also that CISPA legislation, which mainly focused on cybersecurity, and so allowed the government to have the authority to have more effective communications with telecommunication providers, social media, to share information if there was a threat of cybersecurity. But there was fear, for example, that Facebook or MySpace were providing consumers private financial data, even though it may be a cybersecurity threat. There was that Big Brother fear that consumers were scared that they wouldn't know what information was being shared with the government. The Cloud Computing Act was also proposed. It wasn't unsuccessful, and it kind of amended the language of the CFAA to cover cloud computers that are used in cloud computing, but it didn't really add any meaningful protection, and there was criticism that it just complicated the CFAA even more. And then there was two important pieces of legislation. The Cybersecurity Act of 2012, it was unsuccessful, but it has kind of triggered the new Cybersecurity Act of 2013. The goals of both of these was to protect critical infrastructure in the U.S., such as electronic grids or water supplies from rogue hackers or cybersecurity threats. So The 2013 Act has been proposed, and there has been a reflection that Congress's intent this year is at least to focus on cybersecurity and get some type of legislation out there. Another important legislation that went into effect was the American Invents Act. Briefly, while this affects the U.S. patent system more because it changed it from a first-to-invent from a first-to-file system, it did provide this prior commercial use defense for trade secret holders. And what this does is the prior commercial use defense allows a company who maybe want to, instead of pursuing patent, a patent, instead practice their information and, or keep it as a trade secret. And should another company then seek a patent and file later, there would be a defense, a safe harbor for that company that that didn't necessarily seek a patent first, but still was practicing it first. And so it's interesting to see, you know, how this will be flushed out. It does provide an advantage for companies who maybe don't want to pursue a patent, but want and save the cost, but keep their information as a trade secret and still practice it. And then finally, there were some notable state legislative developments. New Jersey became the 47th state to adopt its version of the UTSA. Texas, Massachusetts, I believe New York are the three remaining states who are out there. New Hampshire enacted a notice period for companies who, before they're going to provide an offer to an employee for employment, they have to provide notice and disclose any restrictive covenants or non-competes. Oregon is another state that already has a similar legislation. Massachusetts and Virginia did consider statutes that would limit non-competes similar to California, but those did not pass. Idaho did propose some significant trade secret legislation. It did not pass, but it involved whether, you know, the definition of misappropriation. It provided that misappropriation would occur when trade secret information was either acquired, used, disclosed, or physically retained. But it did not cover the simple memorization of trade secret information. And right now, this is an unresolved issue, whether trade secret information that's memorized could constitute misappropriation. And it's still unsettled, and states vary on their analysis of it. And then finally, Maryland introduced a bill that would invalidate non-competes for employees who've requested or applied for unemployment benefits. And the goal was really to avoid, to remove and eliminate any obstacles for employees who may be unemployed and are seeking employment. And then finally, there was some social media legislation that's out there to protect employees' personal social media accounts. We expect a rising trend in more states to enact their own type of legislation. Maryland and Illinois were the first two states to enact their own type of social media legislation to protect employers from either requesting or requiring applicants or employees to disclose or divulge any of their social media accounts, passwords, usernames, login information. There were some differences in these states so far. For example, Illinois expressly excludes email from being covered. However, California is much more broader and encompasses all types of accounts, social media, email accounts, essentially a lot of stuff that's electronically related. One criticism of California, though, is that it refers to the protection of personal social media, but there's no definition or clarification of what personal actually is. Whereas Michigan, however, has attempted to address this issue and clearly defines, or at least clarifies, what personal versus employer social media is. For example, devices that are paid by the employer, accounts that are provided by the employer, or used for the purposes of the employment relationship. Now, with that, I'll turn it over to the merging issue of trade secret preemption. Robert will discuss this issue.
Thanks, Josh. We briefly got into a little bit of some of the cases on trade secret preemption during the Supreme Court survey. But trade secret preemption is something that's very important. If your company is trying to protect its information, in-house counsel and business leaders need to know about trade secret preemption. Essentially, what we're seeing in the courts is that if you're trying to protect your information and the information doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret, that you may be stuck with just a contract theory as opposed to a contract and common law theory. Typical common law claims in this space are tortious interference with contract, conversion, unfair competition, breach of the duty of loyalty, breach of confidence. And what you're seeing on the screen is essentially from the Uniform Trade Secret Act, and it's the preemption language that has caused a lot of consternation amongst a lot of people. And what you'll see in the language is that the first part says that essentially the act displaces conflicting tort, restitutionary, and other law providing civil remedies for misappropriation of a trade secret. And then as it displaces, then it brings brings claims back by saying, you know, this act does not affect contractual remedies, whether or not based upon misappropriation of a trade secret, or other civil remedies that are not based upon the misappropriation of a trade secret, or criminal remedies, whether or not based upon the misappropriation of a trade secret. And there's a lot of variety in how the courts across the country have been adopting this language. And essentially 47 states have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act. The language with respect to preemption is fairly consistent, adopting this particular language or a iteration of this particular language. And courts have essentially reached different results on what this means and what it means to employers about how to protect their information. If you're in a state that has a strong preemption doctrine and essentially leaves you with a contract theory and a trade secret theory, then what you need to do is make sure you have reasonable secrecy measures in place to protect your trade secrets. You need to make sure you have strong agreements, that you have password-protected computers, that you have procedures in place that if you disclose your information to vendors or customers, that you have non-disclosure agreements with them. Because if you're stuck with a trade secret theory and you later want to sue a competitor or an employee, they're going to pick apart your reasonable secrecy measures, and you're going to be left with maybe a contract theory that doesn't have a lot of value or also has a lot of holes, because they'll use the same arguments that they use to attack your reasonable secrecy measures to show that your information really isn't confidential as defined in the agreement. A very significant decision that came out recently by Judge Koh in the Northern District of California. She, of course, is the judge from the Apple-Samsung case. She issued this recent decision in the SunPower Solar City Corporation case, and it essentially stands for the proposition that trade secret information is not actionable in tort under California law. Now, she does have a very thorough decision, and she acknowledges that there's a lot of conflicting authorities in this space, but she elects and decides that she's going to pursue the theory that the trade secret preemption statute that you saw, you know, displaces common law remedies. It'll be interesting to see if other California courts pick up her line of reasoning, and essentially she grafted onto a footnote that was contained in a California Court of Appeal decision in the Sovaco decision, and she grabbed that footnote, which admittedly is dicta, and took it to expand it to this larger holding. She even acknowledged that there was some competing Ninth Circuit authority, but she indicated that, you know, they had come before Sovaco decision, and she thinks that as a federal judge who's supposed to apply the law of California in a California diversity case, that it's appropriate to apply Sovaco. So it should be interesting to see how the California courts come out this. What you're seeing on the screen now is a number of California cases, and in one instance, a Wisconsin case applying California law. And in the Illumination Management Solutions case and the Form Factor case, in both those cases, the court applied preemption and preempted the common law claims. The one significant thing I wanted to share with you on the Form Factor case is really sort of the practical implications if you're stuck in a world where only contract and trade secret exist. And the court really pointed to, you know, in that case, apart from the preemption analysis, is about how the trade secret claim failed as well. And the claim failed because the court found that there wasn't reasonable secrecy measures. The court pointed that there was no written agreement with the employee. There was no that the employer actually allowed the employee to retain his contact information after he left. the employer allowed the employee to work from home and to share and store information on his particular company computer. The employer didn't request the employee to return any company data when he left. And there was no indication that there was a policy against working from home or backing up and downloading files, company files onto your personal computer. So these are all things to think about if you're stuck in a world where only trade secrets and contract claims exist for your protection of information, that you need to shore up your practices and policies and make sure you have these types of reasonable secrecy measures in place. To show you that it's not all preemption in California, there was a recent case, the Social Apps versus Zynga case. And I think the import of this decision is that the court acknowledges that you could have a claim based upon the theft of information that doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret that's still actionable under a tort theory. And in that particular case, the court held that to the extent that the plaintiff based its breach of confidence claim on Zynga's unauthorized use or disclosure of MyFarm's concepts or game features that did not involve proprietary source code underlying its trade secrets theft claim, that the plaintiff had stated a valid information theft claim separate from its trade secret violation. So there still is traction and authority in California for preemption. And if you're outside of California, you may wonder, well, what's the upshot of these sort of decisions? Well, under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, that's been adopted in 47 states, essentially you can look at decisions from other states in construing how the law should apply as under the trade secret statute. So you're seeing a lot of significant decisions on preemption in California that a lot of other courts, such as the Wisconsin court, may apply in their particular states. Some additional preemption decisions, and this kind of just shows you the across the board about how the decisions vary. In Arizona, employers must choose whether to sue for Uniform Trade Secret Act violation or for preempted claims. So you have to make an election whether if it's the theft of information, you want to say it's a trade secret, or if you want to say it's not a trade secret, but it's our confidential information and we want to pursue a tort theory and a contract theory. In Utah and Indiana and New Hampshire, very broad preemption cases. The Utah Uniform Trade Secret Act preempts many common law claims relating to the allegations of the misuse of confidential information not qualifying as a trade secret. Indiana, the same type of analysis, common law misappropriation and civil conversion claims were preempted. And New Hampshire, also broad preemption. So if you're stuck in one of those jurisdictions, again, make sure you have good policies and procedures documenting what your reasonable secrecy measures are, and also be critical about the information that you're trying to protect. If it's information that's publicly available that you don't protect through vendors or customers, you should really consider whether you want to update those NDAs and provide additional protection measures if you want to pursue a trade secret theory. At this point, I'm going to turn it back to Michael Wexler. He's going to talk about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act circuit split and the recent Aaron Swartz debate.
Before I do that, though, because I see that we're getting close to the top of the hour and we're going to run over slightly, but at this time, if you would take out a piece of paper and a pencil, I want to give you the CLE code so that you can submit that for credit. To receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form found on the last page of your presentation materials. Submit the form to the person indicated on that page. The code is SS5050. That is SS5050. As to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, there has been a split among the circuits, and just by way of a quick background, the CFAA was adopted in 1984 to protect the government's computers against hackers, and it was amended in 1994 to allow for private rights of action by citizens who believe that they were wronged by other citizens. So it became a statute that was widely used by employers when employees left with information or copied information from computers or hacked in. Way back when, there was a case called Shurgard, which basically said that under the statute, unauthorized access was when you went into a computer and you were doing so for a purpose that wasn't for your current employer. It's that particular case and the law that came from that case that has been split now amongst the federal circuits. When you look at the statute, you see that there's language that includes without authorization or exceeding authorization. You need to have damage in connection with that access and a $5,000 minimum loss during a one-year period. So what's happened is a number of the circuits have split on how you interpret that language that's underlined in the slide. So, for example, the Ninth Circuit has said that if you are authorized to access the computer, even if you access the computer for an improper purpose, meaning a purpose for yourself, for a competitor, against your current employer's interests, the Ninth Circuit has come down, and the Fourth Circuit has followed that, has come down and said that is still an authorized access because you're allowed to be in the computer, even though what you were doing in the computer wasn't authorized for your company's business. Other circuits have taken a broader interpretation and would likely say that that type of access didn't, in fact, exceed anything. The case in California, U.S. versus Nosal, is the case I was speaking of, in which the authorization issue has come up and has been followed in the Fourth Circuit. There was a case, just for your information, a fairly recent case in 2012, the Weingann versus Harlan Financial Solutions case, that did essentially call into question the Nosal decision with regard to this issue of authorization. But you should be aware that that this issue is out there and that it's split amongst the circuits. The Fourth Circuit has adopted the Ninth Circuit's narrow interpretation, as I mentioned earlier, in the W.C. Carolina Energy Solutions LLC versus Miller case. And again, other circuits have different opinions on that. Then briefly, it's been in the news lately. Thought we would touch on this. Aaron Swartz was a coder, an entrepreneur, held himself out, as we understand, as a political activist, and was alleged to have inappropriately tried to gain access to information at a university's computer or network. It's alleged that he had tried to download certain information, which may or may not have been information that is available to students and may or may not be public or not. Apparently, the federal government, through U.S. Attorney's Office, brought charges against Mr. Swartz. And recently, he is alleged to have taken his own life. All kinds of speculation as to what those reasons were, but primarily a lot of folks are drawing a conclusion, whether it's right or wrong or not, a conclusion that may have been because of this prosecution. And the question arises then whether or not this is an appropriate prosecution. There's a petition that's going around the Congress, and there's an attempt to pass law that would help to clarify the CFAA and its use. And this is just highlighting, the various interpretations of the CFAA and its use. And so it's something certainly that we want to make you aware of during this presentation. The next slides here regard social media, and I will turn this back to my colleague, Josh Salinas, so that he can talk to you briefly about social media as we get to the top of the hour here.
Thanks, Michael. So in the interest of time, we're going to briefly discuss some of the cases on the following slides, but all these cases have been briefed on our website, tradesecretslaw.com, if you would like further information on the facts or any legal analysis discussions of the case. We have seen some prominent social media cases this year. One of the closely watched and closely followed cases was the Phone Dog versus Kravitz case. It involved a former employee who left Phone Dog, which was a company that provided reviews of mobile devices, telecommunications. And the issue was when Noah Kravitz left the company, he had access to the, I guess it was in dispute, of a Twitter account that had followers for the company, The dispute was who owned it. Did the employee, was it his account or was it the former employer's? So the case eventually, it ended up settling and the former employee was able to keep possession and ownership of the account. But one of the key components, one of the key lessons learned from the case was the importance of having social media ownership agreements to establish agreements, contracts with employees to clearly distinguish and define who is the owner of the social media account and who it's going to be used for. There are also disputes regarding the loss of followers, loss of friends, loss of network contacts, and whether you could have any damages arising for that. And that was illustrated in the Eagle versus Morgan case and also the Loan Companies versus Piggy Paint case. In the Eagle versus Morgan case, the former employee lost access to their LinkedIn accounts, their network contacts, and brought a claim for damages under the CFAA against their former employer. The court found that there were no cognizable damages merely for the loss of those network connections without further facts. And also in the Piggy Paint case, the court said that the loss of a Facebook page and the 19,000 fans that the company lost associated with that page did not necessarily give rise to damages for intentional interference with economic relationships, and specifically that the loss of friends without any specific additional facts wouldn't be sufficient to give rise to damages. Those two cases can be contrasted with the PhoneDog versus Kravitz case, where in that case, PhoneDog was able to, at least at the pleading stage, establish that their loss of their Twitter followers caused damage to the extent that their page was used or gathered advertising revenue that was based on the number of hits and web traffic, and so the loss of traffic to that website associated with the loss of followers, they could at least plead that they had lost damages. The NVIDIA case involved the implications of restrictive covenants in social media. In that case, a hairstylist who left their company had a restrictive covenant for a non-solicitation of customers, posted the change of their employment on Facebook, and the court said that it did not necessarily violate the non-solicitation agreement because there was no direct active solicitation. It was a merely passive notification. And then in the MySpace case, Cristal versus Bport, the court did recognize that a friends list with confidential information on MySpace could be protected as trade secret information and could be proceeded to bring a claim. And we saw some notable injunctions and awards. Briefly, the DuPont case that Robert had previously discussed involved rival Cologne's alleged misappropriation of DuPont's trade secret information regarding bulletproof technology. The extraordinary kind of astonishing injunction that was obtained was a 20-year global manufacturing injunction. The court found that it couldn't detect whether Cologne was merely using trade secret information, and an injunction may not necessarily fully encompass that. So because the alleged misappropriated trade secrets were so integrated and essential to Cologne's initial technology, the court said that it was going to issue a permanent injunction that banned the actual manufacturing of any of the products. Also in that case, one notable legal rule that did arise was that the court did distinguish between the injunctions for the standard for injunctions in patent cases, which is the landmark eBay case, which found that there was no presumption of irreparable harm, and parties seeking an injunction would need to establish all elements to obtain an injunction. But in this case, the court said that it did not apply to trade secret injunctions, so therefore there could be a presumption of irreparable harm, making trade secret injunctions a lot easier to obtain than patent infringement injunctions. Then also we saw a dispute regarding a California pharmaceutical company, Allergan. The court issued a 10-month sale injunction that prevented Merz from issuing a competitive product that was competitive to the Botox. And one of the things the court did was it heavily scrutinized Merz's failure to produce documents timely and noted there were some confidential documents that were produced that were belatedly disclosed. And then finally, we saw the Ninth Circuit in the highly publicized, widely watched Bratz case, Mattel versus MGA. The court this past week, the Ninth Circuit, found that the counterclaim that MGA brought for trade secret misappropriation was not compulsory and by law should not have been brought and reached the jury, and therefore it overturned the $172 million award that the jury issued for trade secret misappropriation damages and attorney's fees. Although MGA was able to keep the damages that it received for the copyright infringement defense. The Ohio Supreme Court also issued a decision that Robert had earlier talked about regarding unfair competition claims and malicious litigation against a smaller business. This case just kind of reinforced the importance of bringing claims to avoid any bad faith, especially on weak claims. And then finally, the SkyCam case involved the SkyCams that we see at sporting events that are overhead, providing an overview of the field. In that case, the injunction for royalties was issued, and instead of a permanent injunction for the sale or manufacturer, but actually royalties for each event in which the alleged trade secrets were being used. And so this just kind of reaffirms the importance of not only the ability to request an injunction, but also for the royalties that should be pursued if possible in the alternative. And with that, we'll open up. We have received some questions. If we don't reach them, we will provide emails to the individuals to in response to your questions.
As to the questions, we have a couple of them here. We're happy to go through them. And as Josh said, we can certainly send emails. One question was, what do I do if I have an old signed sales agreement that contains non-compete language? If it's not enforceable, are there penalties or issues? Generally, in California, the 16,600 statute makes non-compete agreements illegal for employees absent a sale of a business situation. And consequently, by having such an agreement, you can violate the 17,200 statute, which is essentially illegal trade practices, and there are attorney general rulings, or PAGA rulings are called, which also can impose liability to a company that uses non-competes in California. There are obviously strategies to try and deal with that situation, as well as ways to correct the situation, such as having new agreements and using certain strategies in those new agreements to protect confidential information as well as customers and goodwill.
There was also a question with respect, what's the line between trade secret protection and blogging? And I think that's a real important question, because think of a technology company that's unveiling a new product, and you have employees that are in the know that know about that new product, but it hasn't been released to market. Perhaps this employee is a blogger, uses social media, is on Facebook. I think it's important for companies where they are in that position, where there's going to be a new product launch or whatnot, to remind employees of their non-disclosure obligations and make sure that they have social media policies that address blogging. There's nothing magical about blogging that would take information that is legitimately confidential or trade secret information and therefore protect it. You would still have a claim. There can be issues with First Amendment and whistleblowing and whatnot, but if it's legitimate information that's protectable under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, such as a certain product that's about ready to go to launch that nobody knows about, it's an important reminder to employers to have policies that address blogging and social media.
There are some couple other questions here, but we see that we're past the hour at this point. And so if you have any further questions, please feel free to contact us. I think our contact information, we'll show that again just for a moment here. I'm sorry. Just for a moment here, if you want to reach us, there is our contact information, as well as, again, our Trade Secrets blog at tradesecretslaw.com. Also, we have in hard copies and CDs. An entire review of the 2012, including all of our blog postings. It also includes various resources that we have regarding the trade secret non-compete area, as well as We have reviews for 2012 as well that go over a review of all of our blogs and also a review of the highlights from all of the webinars from 2012. You can also go to our blog, and there you can request information to privately view, or I should say listen to, previous webinars, and the ability to also, in certain states, obtain CLE credit for listening to those webinars. And again, to get materials from us in a hard copy CD and electronic formats. So we are glad you could join this webinar today. Please check your email. We will have additional webinars this year, as we have in past years, and we look forward to your attendance at future webinars. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Us today. This concludes today's web conference. You may now disconnect.